A lot of times on Sunday nights, it's time to talk about maybe some things of a practical nature, maybe not something that you'd want to talk about if you were especially hopeful of influencing maybe a visitor, such as we sometimes have on Sunday morning, to obey the gospel, but something that would nevertheless be of practical value to us. And one of the things that is popular, I don't know if you'd say pastime, if that's really the right expression, but certainly a popular activity in our society is gambling. And most people that have grown up in the church know you're not supposed to gamble. And yet, sometimes when people are asked, well, why not? It's not that easy to answer. We are, after all, a people who say we ought to speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent. What does the Bible have to say about gambling? The only book of the Bible I know of that talks about gambling is Hezekiah. And if you think about that for a second, you'll recognize there is no book of Hezekiah in the Bible. I don't know any passage in the Bible that talks about gambling. Somebody said, well, you ought to sit down and shut up. Then we're going to speak where the Bible speaks. We're going to be silent where the Bible is silent. Then it would seem that there is nothing more to say about that particular topic. Well, I think it's important for us to give some consideration to what Bible principles might apply to everything, whether it's mentioned in the Bible or not. There are all kinds of things that are present in one society or another society that may or may not be mentioned in the Bible. When we talk about speaking where the Bible speaks and being silent where the Bible is silent, that doesn't just apply to this particular word or that particular word. It's talking about basic Bible teaching and Bible principle. And I want to talk about some basic Bible principles tonight that I think relate to that particular subject. And while you might be saying, well, you know, I really don't care about gambling. I don't gamble. I don't fool with it. Mainly the people just get in my way in the line at the fast food. That's my main interaction with gambling, I suppose, is I get irritated with all the people lined up at the convenience store. Convenience store is not a convenience store when there are five people in front of them that want to buy their lottery tickets. I'm not that interested. But I want to suggest that I think what really is problematic about gambling is not peculiar to gambling, and can impact us in other aspects of our life as well. And so even though you might say, well, I don't do that, don't have any desire to do that, what's the difference? I want you to think about some principles that we will eventually talk about this evening. I might also say that there is some base of doing this. Some of you may have come here as students from states where they don't have a lottery. Although most states, I think, across the Union now do have a lottery. Hasn't been that many years that almost nobody had a lottery. And gambling was something that in most states was illegal. In fact, in the state of Florida, gambling is still illegal, except for the government, unless you do it through the government. Now, if you do it through the government, it's legal and moral, but if you do it otherwise, it's illegal. And I might point out that it is covered by the vice squad. You can think about that, too. It's not just an illegality. It's covered by the vice squad. It's interesting, the attitude that the world has towards gambling in that respect. If you talk about gambling, most anybody out there in the world, even if they gamble, they think of that as something that is a little bit on the shady side, that there's something at least a little bit wrong with it. And the fact that it is regulated by state governments, prohibited in most cases, as I say, treated by the vice squad, that ought to tell us something about how it is perceived. Somebody said, well, there's a lot of criminal activity associated with it. And that's probably true, too. Somebody might say, yeah, but the only reason there's criminal activity is because they outlawed it. If they hadn't outlawed it, then ordinary people would do it, and then it wouldn't be associated with criminals. But I'm not so sure about that either. The fact of the matter is, though, whether it's legal or illegal, it's all around us. The lottery, of course, recently implemented here in the state of Florida. And as fact of the matter is, recent initiative in our own government in the state of Florida requiring apparently going to require a great deal more expenditure on education. Some government officials, including the governor, have even asked, well, maybe we ought to consider legalizing casino gambling now. so that we could draw some of the revenue from Atlantic City and Las Vegas and use that to fund our schools. It's always interesting when states start to establish some sort of gambling. It's always, we're going to use the money to benefit the schools. Every state, I think, has done this, always made that argument. We're going to use the money to benefit the schools. And that's interesting, too. Why not just say, we're just going to supply general tax revenue? Why not say, we're going to implement the lottery because people like to gamble? And we're going to, you know, we're going to provide some gambling for them. That'd be a good opportunity. Seems to me, if it's a legitimate activity, that'd be reasonable enough justification right there, whether you collected any money for the schools or not. I think, once again, that's a little bit of a testimony that comes from the world itself, that there's something tainted about this. For some, now, that people might have a hard time putting their finger on exactly what it is. I think a lot of times we have a little difficulty putting our finger on exactly what it is that's tainted about this particular activity. But the fact that people who want to implement it, and implement it on large scale, do so by saying, look, we're going to put the money to a good purpose, as though that would somehow atone for, somehow justify the shadiness of the operation itself. I'm going to suggest that I think there are crucial problems with gambling, though I would not try to argue that everybody that ever flipped pennies had fallen into a deep sin. Sometimes we focus on the little details and we miss the big picture, I think. I do think, even if you say it doesn't affect you, it will affect a lot of you. It will affect a lot of you. I would guarantee you that, especially with the big win today, there are going to be a lot more office pools and bigger office pools here in the Tampa Bay area. Lotteries and you know, gambling on the football games and so on. And when you step out of the relative security of your classroom and into the business world, you'll find that your people that you work with and a lot of companies will be expecting you to join the office gambling pool. And, you know, you're a new employee, you're wanting to fit in. Well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I only want a buck. What's the big deal? I'd give him a buck. I don't care whether I win or not. And so you're going to have circumstances where that is, in fact, going to come up. And you may have people that ask you. And we ought to be able to think through the various things that go on. And it's not just lotteries. I mean, here in Florida, we've got dog races and horse races and many other things as well. I do believe that many times the answers that those of us who warn about gambling, who try to say that there's something wrong with it, maybe we're not always as thoughtful as we should be. For example, those who would condemn gambling will often point out that some people fall into compulsive gambling, and that is definitely true. And there are people who, in the gambling process, get, you know, with the big win or the big loss, they become addicted to it quite strongly. And when they win, there's a big adrenaline rush that comes, as with other activities sometimes, and they just get addicted to that. And that's the only way they know how to manage things. And if you were to go to some of the groups that work with those people, they could give you stories about how gambling had destroyed lives and destroyed families, just like alcoholism has. And so it is certainly proper to point to that danger and note that a number of people, not everybody, not the majority, but a significant number of people who choose to gamble end up destroying their lives and the lives of those that they love because of that behavior. But on the other hand, I don't know that the fact that some do that by itself would prove that it would be a sin for everybody. It'd be a pretty good argument that, you know, it's not very wise to do that. But the fact is, many people have gambled and never, you know, done so compulsively. And so I'm not sure that we could say from that 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 alone makes it unscriptural. It might make it unwise, but unscriptural, I'm not sure I'd make that argument. Other people say, well, it's a sin because it gave a chance. Well, I'm not sure what Bible verse we would base that on. I do know one verse in the Bible that talks about the race is not to the strong The race is not the swift, victory to the strong, or bread to the man of understanding, but time and chance happens to them all. That from Ecclesiastes chapter 11. And I didn't say that chance was sinful. It just says some things happen that you can't predict. I don't know any passage of the Bible that says to engage in something that involves chance is sinful. I don't think I'd make that argument. Most of us engage in things that have some risk, some chance attached to them all the time. Somebody that invests in the stock market, as most people who've, even with their retirement plans, put money in the stock market, have become acutely aware that time and chance happens to all of us. And most of them put their money in the stock market hoping it would go up, and it went down. Was that a sin? Or I suppose you could take that, you know, if it's just a matter of chance, that proves it's wrong. Well, then somebody could ask, well, if you played poker long enough that you got good enough that you could predictably win, would that not be a sin anymore? You know, say, I'm not taking a chance, I'm going to win. Or I suppose you could argue that way, and you could say, well, maybe it'd be wrong to play at a casino, but it sure wouldn't be wrong to operate a casino, because let me tell you something, they don't lose. The owners of casinos are not taking any chances at all. They know they're going to win. They know they're going to make money off of you. So, not sure how you'd, maybe you could take all the customers away from them. But point is, I think if we're looking for biblical principles to apply, the mere fact that it is, as we sometimes say, a game of chance doesn't really necessarily prove anything about it. One could argue, as has often been done, that, you know, if you gamble, you just inevitably end up associating with a lot of unsavory characters. And that, too, is often true. It is interesting. What state is the oldest gambling establishment in our country? I mean, what state is, for the longest time, approved of gambling? Well, Nevada. And parallel that, what state, I guess to my knowledge is the only state, I haven't researched this, what state is the only state that legalizes prostitution? Nevada. What state has been a center of mob activity? Despite not having many people in it? Nevada. Yeah, there's a lot of unsavory characters that are connected. I come back, I was watching, in fact, the Travel Channel the other day. And something very ironic to me was they were showing about going to Las Vegas, and particularly this show was all about catching the cheaters at the casinos. And I don't know whether anybody happened to stumble across that particular show or not, but they were showing how they have all these hidden cameras and have all of these plainclothes spies walking around who know all of the tricks of the trade and watch the cheaters. Some of the people that are dealers are hired by the casinos, and they cheat or try to cheat and cooperate with the customer and split the money. Some people learn tricks to try to cheat this game or that game. Some people just walk in and know there's a lot of people with a lot of cash or a lot of, I guess, redeemable chips lying around, and they just steal. You know, they just look for somebody to lay the purse down and steal. And if you think about it, it's really, I mean, that's what the whole show was about. And it had all of these officers from the casinos there who were, of course, all dressed in suits as impeccable businessmen. And they were talking about, you know, what a clean operation and how careful they were to make sure that all the rules were strictly enforced and how they caught all of the cheaters that were there. And to me, that was amazingly ironic on a couple of levels. First of all, you're operating a business, the whole point of which is people are wanting to get money they haven't worked for, and you're surprised that thieves show up? You're surprised that cheaters show up? You think they know what's coming, and they're not doing that to protect their customers. They're doing that to protect themselves. But the other thing is, to me, it was all kind of ironic that in doing this, there was sort of the implicit, see how moral we are. See how clean this really can be, how untainted this really is. Without pointing out that they have very carefully calculated the odds so that they know full well that everybody that comes in there is probably going to lose. And there will be some winners, but there will be a lot more losers. And they make sure that plenty of liquor flows and plenty of attractive, scantily clad ladies are walking around to keep the level of excitement high, to keep everybody's egos high, and keep the money flowing as fast as it can, without any serious regard for the families and the lives that they are destroying. Somebody said, well, some of them are rich and they can afford it. Yeah, I understand that. And I come back to the point that if you're going to gamble, yeah, you're going to associate, at that level at least, at casinos, maybe not in the 7-Eleven line, buying a lotto ticket, but yeah, there's an awful lot of unsavory characters. But once again, you know, I don't know that that proves by itself that gambling is wrong. Yeah, it's a good warning. But I think there are still some other very important biblical principles that are involved. I want to turn to Exodus chapter 20. 20th chapter of the book of Exodus. We had some detailed study of this not long ago. This is where God, to the children of Israel at Mount Sinai, spoke the Ten Commandments. The only words that God ever spoke to a whole nation of people from heaven. All the rest of the law of Moses was mediated through Moses. In the New Testament, God sent His Son. And here in Exodus chapter 20, as we go through the Ten Commandments, you are familiar with them, and you'll recall that the last of the Ten Commandments was, "You shall not covet." Verse 17, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." Many people have observed that this particular commandment is in some ways unique among the ten. You see, all the rest of the Ten Commandments address things you actually do. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not make any graven image. You shall honor your father and mother. But this addresses not the practice, but the attitude, the heart. Some people have said this is the most Christian, if you will, of all of the commandments. Because even though he had said back in verse 15, "You shall not steal," it was not adequate simply to say, "You shall not steal." He goes on to say, "You shall not covet." And of course, it is covetousness that leads to theft. And it is saying that God is not just concerned with what we actually do. He is concerned with what's going on inside us spiritually. He is concerned with the inner spiritual man, even in the Old Testament, which we think of, and in some ways is true, is largely concerned with, you know, external things in some ways. But God has always also been concerned about the interior, the spiritual heart, what's inside a man. Covetousness. What is covetousness? We don't use that particular term a lot, but one that means about the same thing is greed. And we use that, and we understand that. Greed can express itself in a lot of ways. Desire to have more than you've earned. A willingness to sacrifice everything to acquire more money. To spend all your time working. Maybe you're going to work to earn it. And not serve the Lord, not attend to the needs of your family or other things that you ought to be doing. Greed. To profit sometimes by someone else's misfortune. Why is gambling such a potent force? Because, it seems to me, it is built entirely on and designed to cultivate this particular flaw in the heart of man. Man's greed. An attitude to acquire, to have more, by whatever means. We need to be aware of what our spiritual weaknesses are. And we need to realize that Satan and those that in various guises might serve as his agents are particularly adept at finding and exploiting the weaknesses in the human heart, the things that we are likely to be subject to, things that can be cultivated and grow and produce basically a heart that is turned away from God. When you gamble, where's the money you win come from? It all comes from somebody else. Somebody else's misfortune. When I was in the state of Illinois, they started the lottery when I was up there. I came to Florida and they started a lottery here. Maybe I ought not go to any other states. But anyway, it's just kind of the wave of what's happening. But they would advertise a big million-dollar winner. But of course, every time there was a million-dollar winner, there were approximately 3 million $1 losers. And, you know, there are huge revenues that come even with the simple lottery. The person that wins basically takes money from others. What's our basic attitude towards material things? Basic attitude towards material things. I'm going to suggest that gambling cultivates an illicit desire. Whether it's big or little, it cultivates the illicit desire in our heart for material things. I want you to think about what the Bible says just about us and material things. Passage that had occasion to refer to this morning in our Bible class, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28. In Ephesians 4th chapter and verse 28, Paul says, "Let him who steals steal no longer, but rather let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need." Now, that's an attitude that we would not have a desire to acquire things that don't belong to us. We would work. And work, notice, not simply out of greed, not so we can be rich, but work so we can be generous. Work so we can be generous, so we can give to others that have need. Luke chapter 3 and verse 14. When John the Baptist began to call on the Jewish people to repent, to reform their hearts in preparation for the coming of the Messiah, various groups came to him and said, "Well, what should we do?" And in verse 12, it says some tax gatherers came to be baptized, and they said, "Teacher, what should we do?" And he said, "Collect no more than what you have been ordered to." And some soldiers were questioning him, saying, "And what about us? What should we do?" And he said to them, "Do not take money from anyone by force." And of course, you know, the tax gatherers don't collect anything more than what you've been ordered. Don't cheat people. And of course, the soldiers don't take money by force. Don't extort money. Well, naturally, we say, well, those are theft. But then notice the last part, and be content with your wages. Be content with what you have. In Philippians chapter 4, sometimes we look at the New Testament account of all of the things that the Apostle Paul did, and we wonder, how could anybody do those types of things? And in Philippians, the 4th chapter, the 8th verse, to start with, Paul says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things." Think about that. He says, I mean, you know, there are a lot of times that we have to just have our mind on what we're doing. But there are times that we get to sit back and reflect on things. And maybe for a brief moment, maybe for an extended period. He says, these are the types of things that we ought to fill our minds with, fill our hearts with, that we ought to think about. I ask you in that list, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, where's greed and covetousness in that? Where's striking it rich? Talking about an attitude that applies to a lot more things than just gambling. But you know, the person that gambles, you know, it's easy even for a person who doesn't gamble to sit around and say, "What if I won the lottery? What would I do?" It's interesting. Most people that think about What if I won the lottery? What would I do? You know one of the first things most people say? Well, I'd give a bunch to such and such. It's almost like that first step is we have to redeem our winnings by giving some of it away or something like that, seems to be the idea. And in fact, there was just this past week a couple of articles I noticed in the paper where a fellow who had won quite a bit of money in the lottery had offered to give a portion of it, I think it was $100,000, to the Salvation Army. Salvation Army turned it down because they regarded it as tainted. I suppose you could argue about that. I heard one brother say, he said, I'd be glad to have it. Said, money served the devil long enough, we'll put it to some good use now. And so I suppose you could argue about whether that's what they should have done or not. I must say, I appreciated a principled thing. And I'll tell you, somebody said, well, what would you do if you won the lottery? Well, I have a hard time, winning without buying any tickets. But I suppose I could just accidentally find one that somebody had dropped, and it could be the big winning ticket, or something. Or I could do what one fellow told me about doing. He said he wanted to teach his kid not to gamble, so he had his kid buy a lottery ticket and then lose and say, see, you lost your dollar. You threw it away. I don't know what he'd have done if his kid had won. But in any case, I suppose there could be some circumstance where you might innocently come across it. What would you do? I don't know. Hard to predict. But I think if I was going to give it away, I probably ought to give it all away. I told my wife one time, I said, I know how to live on what I make. I don't have any idea how you live on $80 million. And I think it might be an opportunity to make a great statement. But it's interesting that that there is that sense of a need to redeem things. But to return to my point here, as we look at these passages, also in Philippians chapter 4, pick up reading with me in verses 11 through 13. The occasion of Paul writing this letter was the church at Philippi had sent him some additional support. And, of course, he's in prison. But there in prison, he was apparently able actually to rent a room, so to speak, where he was under a sort of a house arrest situation. Probably had to pay not only for the room, but probably also had to pay for the soldier that guarded him. In any case, in that way, he was able to receive those that came and communicate, as he's doing in writing this letter, and really to continue preaching the gospel. And part of the reason he'd been able to do that is because the Philippians, perhaps others, but the Philippians had sent him some money. And so he's thankful for what they've sent. But then in verse 11, he says, not that I speak from want, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of being filled and of going hungry, both of having abundance and of suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. And when we ask this question, how was Paul able to do all of these things? Because somehow he had come to grips with the fact that your life didn't consist in what you possessed. That was more or less the accident of the circumstances in which you lived. And yeah, if you were impoverished or poor or in prison as he was, it's nice to get some help. And he's thankful for it, grateful to the Lord. But life doesn't consist in that. And in that, Paul had learned what our Lord teaches. Matthew chapter 6, in the Gospel of Matthew, the 6th chapter. Starting in verse 19, Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And then just a little bit later in this same passage, in verse 24, he goes on to say, no man can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon, a term for basically wealth. It says you can't serve both of them. And then a little further on, he says, don't be anxious verse 25, for your life is to what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor for your body is to what you shall put on. Is not life more than food and the body than clothing? He says, look at the birds. Your Father takes care of them. And then in verse 28, look at the lilies of the field, their beauty, their glory. Verse 29, yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more do so for you, O men of little faith? It says, do not be anxious then, saying, what shall we eat or what shall we drink or with what shall we clothe ourselves? For all these things the Gentiles eagerly seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. He doesn't say you'll become super rich. He says the food that you'll need for each day and the clothes that you'll need for each day, you'll have those. Verse 34, therefore, do not be anxious for tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. A little sort of interesting sidelight. I teach college. One of the advantages of an older college, a bigger college, prestigious college, people that graduate from there, you've probably heard, you college students heard people say, look, if you only graduate from high school, chances are your life earnings are going to be at such and such a level. But if you graduate from college, you know, then the odds are you're, probably shouldn't use that expression, the odds are, in this, maybe you're just gambling by going to college. But, you know, if you graduate from college, you got a good chance you're going to make a whole lot more over a lifespan. That's true. And, of course, colleges need donors. And the more successful your graduates are, the more business majors that are top-notch business majors that go out there and make a mint, and the more that become doctors and lawyers and other really high-paying professionals, the more ambitious your graduates are, the more money they're going to make. The more money they're going to make as alumni, the more they're going to be able to give back to the school. So you want rich, ambitious graduates. Most of our graduates end up being elementary school teachers or preachers. Or something else like that. Oh, yeah, some are blessed with very good success. And some have been very generous to us. But on average, you know, I'm happy. I'm happy that our goal is not to see how rich and ambitious a student we can graduate so that they can come back and give us more money. That's the standard of the world. That's the standard of the world. And I say that because, again, I'm trying to emphasize the principles that I think God is talking to us about in passages like this are principles that apply in all kinds of aspects of our lives. Gambling is one area where they can show up. What really is our attitude towards material things? I would say gambling is an activity that particularly eats at that little part of the human heart that so readily falls prey to covetousness and seeking after material things and the things of this world. Jesus also said, Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, all things therefore whatsoever you would that men should do unto you, do you also likewise unto them. I'm not sure how in the world you'd apply that in a gambling circumstance. I suppose what it means is you ought to strive to be a loser. If you gamble, you ought to try to lose. Because if what you really want is for other people to lose their money so that you can win, then you ought to be striving to lose. Pretty hard to try to fit that in, isn't it? How could you possibly apply that? You know, one of the qualifications for an elder is that he not be greedy of filthy lucre. What is actually at issue, it seems to me, in this popular activity, though there are a lot of other considerations, it is certainly a valid consideration, possibility that you might become addictive in the behavior. It is certainly a valid consideration that you may have to swim with a lot of sharks if you get involved in gambling. It is certainly a valid consideration to realize the influence that you might have on somebody else who might do those things. But what's really at issue is what's our whole attitude towards our fellow man and towards material things. Why should somebody who lives by the golden rule, why should somebody, can you imagine the Lord? I realize it's hard to imagine the Lord doing a lot of things, but I suppose I have a hard time imagining Jesus driving a car. But can you imagine the Lord sitting down at a little friendly poker game and wiping out the other guys and saying, oh boy, somehow it doesn't fit, does it? Why? You say he's not supposed to be gambling? He's not supposed to have that attitude towards things and taking things from others. Like I said, there's some other ways that you might apply this. A lot of times people think, well, maybe I don't think about winning the lottery because I don't think I should gamble, but I think about finding a lot of money or somehow hitting it rich, my ship coming in, the big thing, maybe inheriting great sums of money. I realize that there's nothing sinful about inheriting a great sum of money. But the Bible tells us there's something pretty dangerous about it. In fact, if you look at Jesus' account of the prodigal son, it looks to me like that father's inheritance didn't do either the prodigal son or the other son any good. If you think back to Thaxter's lecture on that some time ago, Thaxter's class on that, both of them got hung up on that good inheritance that their father was able to pass on to them. Proverbs chapter 20. Proverbs 20th chapter. And the 21st verse. An inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. And you think about how many people, having gotten a big inheritance, it's pretty rare for children to do better with money that they've inherited than the parents did in coming to acquire the money to start with. It's pretty rare. And the Bible warns us about that. But above all, it keeps warning us about our attitude towards material things and our fellow man. The Old Testament prophets were never more indignant than when dealing with those who took advantage of the poverty, the misfortune of other people. You know, in the Old Testament, they were commanded not even to take interest when they loaned money. It may be that that was specifically in the case of loaning to poor people. But it's talking about an attitude there. And in Psalm 15, when it talks about who is able to ascend into the hill of the Lord, one of the qualifications is that very matter, not putting out your money to usury. And you know, I say, well, you know, people who gamble willingly. So you're just taking it away from people who were willing. Probably some truth to that. But it's not entirely so. In some ways, state-sponsored gambling is even more reprehensible than mob-sponsored gambling. The mob, at least you know, they're in the business of cheating and stealing. The state's supposed to be protecting people, helping people. You know what state lotteries are? One of the reasons I would refuse to participate is not just for fear of becoming greedy, not just a general principled opposition to gambling, sort of in a broad principle. State-sponsored lotteries are largely a tax on stupidity. And to the degree that they're not a tax on stupidity, they're a tax on hopelessness. You got all these people that don't make very much, but they just hope that someday their ship's going to come in. And they know they're not going to come up with some great invention, and they know that no rich uncle is going to die, And they just look for something to have hope in. And $2 or $3 in the lottery every week is to them, you know, not a lot to pay to have just a little hope that somehow, somewhere, things would get better for them. Why should I seek to profit off of that? What type of heart is it that wants to profit and get their money? Because that's where most of it comes from. Oh, there's some business people that gamble, but not many. They know better. Why should I seek to profit off of the weak, the helpless, people that are already fairly poor, who are just wanting to take that dollar and buy some little ray of hope in their own unfortunate way? What is my attitude towards my fellow man? You can dress it up in a lot of ways and say it's for education. But at the bottom, I want to live in such a way that what I do glorifies God. And I don't see how getting rich off of somebody else's money glorifies God. And I do see how it cultivates a desire in my heart for the very thing that God says I shouldn't be focused on. I return to the passage with which we began with our reading this evening. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Picking up this time about verse 6. He talked about some who think that godliness is a means of gain. He says, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. This is St. Paul who said he knew how to be content with or without. And when he says godliness is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment, he's not talking about material gain. He says godliness is a means of gaining something that transcends your material concerns. For he says we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierce themselves with many a pang. I was pretty full about warnings. The wise man will heed. Just a moment, we're going to stand and sing our invitation song, as is so often the case on Sunday evenings especially. These lessons are not designed to convert somebody to Christ. But Christ is always the measure of everything. And when we talk about this, we wouldn't talk about it except that we want to be like Christ because He's our Savior. And if you want to become like Jesus, you need to die with Him. You need to die from a world that is focused on money and material things and everything else and be raised to walk in newness of life where we are content with such things as we have. If you're subject to the invitation, ready to come and confess Jesus as your Lord and to repent and obey the gospel and be baptized, we extend the invitation as we stand and sing together.